From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Senator Elizabeth Warren's proposing the federal government get into the prescription drug business. She's calling on the government to manufacture or contract for generic drugs when prices spike or no company is manufacturing a generic. What effects could that have on drug prices? We'll debate it right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Who knew that a sentencing hearing could be so dramatic when the sentencing is postponed? But that's what happened this morning in Michael Flynn's sentencing hearing in D.C. Federal Court. The judge, as you just heard on NPR News, blasting the retired three-star general and President Trump's first national security advisor. But the judge telegraphing it might be best to wait for sentencing, telegraphing that to the defense team of Flynn because of Flynn's ongoing cooperation with federal investigators. So a date to be determined. We'll have more details and look at the complexities of that move in court today. That'll be coming up later on Air Talk. But first, we turn our attention to a bill that's been introduced in both the Senate and House of Representatives by Democrat Elizabeth Warren and Democrat Jan Schakowsky. The bill would put the government in the prescription drug business. Warren, of course, a Massachusetts senator and a possible presidential candidate. Schakowsky is from Illinois. The bill would allow the Department of Health and Human Services to manufacture or to contract for the manufacture of generic drugs. The government could step in when competition is limited and prices of generics spike. It would also allow HHS to make drugs when no company is willing to do so. What would be the effects on the price of generics and the willingness of companies to hardly compete over generic sales? My pleasure to welcome two esteemed analysts when it comes to our healthcare system, frequent Air Talk guest, Dr. Kavita Patel of the Brookings Institution and Johns Hopkins Medicine. She's a practicing primary care physician, as well as policy expert, and Ovik Roy, president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, a nonprofit. He's policy editor at Forbes and has been a policy advisor to Marco Rubio, Rick Perry, and Mitt Romney. Dr. Patel, let me start with you to just flesh this out a bit more. Is there a specific example that you think of that this legislation could apply to?
Yeah, absolutely, Larry, and thanks for having me. There's just an example that actually Senator Warren and Representative Schakowsky call out is insulin. So this is it's a drug that's been around for a very long time, and we've seen spikes in the double digits in prices of insulin, a generic drug. There's been a lot of attention on other drugs. I can tell you clinically that we've had everything from saline shortages to some of the basic antibiotics that we use. And that's exactly what the spirit of this bill is. It's not for the government to come in and take over anything that, honestly, the private sector hasn't abandoned, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Is there an objective way to determine what a price spike is, that, you know, particular percentage increase over time that would open the door for the government to contract or manufacture the generic?
Yeah, and there's definitely kind of standards, and certainly drug manufacturers even today tend to use, when they're thinking about their own pricing, they'll use kind of an average manufacturer price, or they'll look at what an average sales price might be, and they'll try to think about how to just even right now, today, kind of compete on price. So when we look at potentially where this Office of Drug Manufacturing could go, they could identify a condition where the price, they mentioned price is a barrier to access, and it could be something like, you know, there isn't a drug available that's within a 10% range even of affordability. So there, it depends on the kind of, this also depends on the original cost of the goods to make. You don't want to penalize anyone and ask them to pay less than what it costs to manufacture the drug. So that's why something that's used in the industry is what's called an average manufacturing price, and that could be a benchmark. But perhaps more important, it's actually that there are three conditions that are listed that no company is manufacturing the drug, or only one or two companies make the drug, and the price has spiked, like that insulin increase, or the drug is in shortage. And then a final condition of only one or two companies produce the drug, the price is a barrier to patient access, and the drug is listed as an essential medicine by the World Health Organization. So an antibiotic would be a good example of that.
We're talking with Dr. Kavita Patel of Brookings and Johns Hopkins Medicine, Ovik Roy, the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Ovik, good to have you with us again. What are your concerns about this legislation?
Hi, Larry. Well, first of all, let me just say, I think it is extremely important to encourage there to be competition in areas where we don't have it. Competition has been proven over the last many years to be the biggest driver of lower prices in our prescription drug system, particularly when drugs go off patent. So that general concept and philosophy and intention of this bill, I think, is not controversial. I would say I would categorize my skepticism about the bill in two buckets. One would be the how, and two would be the why. So on the how front, how exactly would this Office of Drug Manufacturing be able to work in such a way that, first of all, it's compliant with the incredibly rigorous technical specifications that the FDA requires for drug manufacturing, and B, do so in a way that is dynamic and competitive with what happens in the private sector. I don't see a lot of evidence that a new agency within HHS would be able to manufacture in a cost-effective way that competes with what these established manufacturers in the private sector do. And again, also how the FDA, from a legal standpoint, would have the proper oversight over such an office that would apparently be independent within the Health and Human Services Department and therefore not directly under the FDA's jurisdiction. So that's the how. And then the thing that I think is actually more fundamental here is the why, which is to say I don't see this bill as really thinking through why it is we lack competition where we do. And it turns out that in most of the cases, particularly for off-patent drugs where we lack competition, the reason why we lack competition is due either to the FDA being somewhat aggressive, shall we say, in restricting competition through failing to approve alternate competitors, or there are situations where a combination of the way Medicare pays for drugs and FDA regulations has led manufacturers to conclude that it's not economical for them to produce drugs at commodity prices in a particular area. So what I would have loved to have seen in this bill is more thought on those fronts, to really think through what is it that the FDA could be doing differently to encourage more competitors to enter markets, and where should we rethink the way Medicare in particular pays for drugs such that generics are encouraged to enter the market. Without understanding those two components, all we're doing here is attempting to patch over a problem the federal government has actually caused, and the patch may not actually work.
Well, let's talk about the FDA restrictions on competition, as you put it. Presumably, the FDA is positioning this as health and safety restrictions and making sure the efficacy is going to be there for generics under supervised manufacturing. In what areas, Ovik, do you think that goes too far?
Yeah, so absolutely the FDA has a proper public role in guaranteeing the safety of our prescription drug supply, and they should continue to do so. But there have been examples, and I think if you talk to generic manufacturers, what they'll tell you is that sometimes the inspection regime that the FDA imposes on them makes it impractical for them to manufacture drugs where they otherwise would be willing to enter a market. So that might involve for example, the length of time involved in a review. It may involve uncertainty as to exactly when reviews will happen and what the cost of those reviews will be. It may have to do with plants that otherwise seem to be working fine, but otherwise are being delayed by inspection. So it's not to say that the FDA shouldn't guarantee the public safety of our drug supply. They absolutely should, but we have to think through where the FDA is perhaps doing so in a way that makes it uneconomical for generic manufacturers to come in. Remember,
okay.
This is a fairly highly regulated market, and because of competition, generic prices, drugs that are off patent are often priced at a very low rate. A bottle of mineral water can cost more than certain generic drugs. So it's important for us to understand that whatever regulatory burdens we're putting on these companies, that we're aware of the cost of that regulatory,
okay,
so that we don't discourage people from entering.
I want to get back to Kavita in a moment, but Ovik, I just wanted to follow up on your Medicare reimbursement issue. So are you saying that Medicare is paying too low a price for some of these generics, meaning there's no profit potential for the manufacturer?
Well, it's not so much a matter of low that can come into play, but it has to do with fluctuations due to the average selling price plus 6% formula that particularly Medicare Part B uses. That's the section of Medicare that involves drugs that are infused in a physician's office typically. And that can involve a lot of cancer drugs. And so what will happen is, due to just fluctuations in the market, the price of a drug may go up at one point, then may go down, and then a manufacturer all of a sudden is in a crunch where they're spending all this money on the infrastructure to manufacture a drug, but they can't make money selling the drug. And so it's not so much that the price is too low, but perhaps that the price is not always stable enough for these generic drugs.
Okay.
There may be a way to rethink that formula such that you do have a market element to it, so that you can keep the price pressure low or towards drug prices being lower, but also have enough stability that, again, manufacturers aren't discouraged from entering the market.
We're talking with Ovik Roy, president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Dr. Kavita Patel, let's talk, first of all, Ovik's critique about that much of the problem getting competition in generics is a result of FDA uncertainty in the approval process and the length of process, the hoops that manufacturers have to go through. Your response to that?
I don't think that this is necessarily about regulatory risk, whether it's the FDA or anybody else from like a regulatory standpoint. I think that it's pretty clear that this is, and by the way, Larry, there's already a non-for-profit group that's been started by eight hospital systems called Project Civica that actually was begun this year to address exactly what Senator Warren has in her legislation. So, and they certainly have not had any hurdles from a regulatory standpoint, and they're established as a 501c3 nonprofit. This really is an issue of the fact that we have such a flourishing kind of pharmaceutical industry. By the way, I would add vaccines into this. We also do have shortages at times and a lack of supply of vaccine manufacturers. This is really a supply and demand issue. And when we're talking, I mean, Larry, we're not talking about blockbuster new drugs. We're talking about things like insulin. And at our hospital, we had a shortage of vials of saline. And then you start to unpack, like, well, why is it that nobody's making this? Yes, of course, if I paid $100 for each vial, then maybe people would rush in to make this. But the truth is that a lot of this has just been abandoned, and they're not necessarily a high priority. And that doesn't have anything to do with the FDA. It really has a lot more to do with the availability of interest from a market that can be public or private. And I think that's I applaud the two legislators for putting this forward and starting the conversation.
We're talking with Dr. Kavita Patel of Brookings and Johns Hopkins Medicine, Ovik Roy, the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. If you have questions for our guests about how this legislation would work if it were to be passed, obviously in the Senate, that would be uphill as Republicans control the Senate. Nonetheless, it's a very good debate to have about whether the government stepping in with generic generic drugs would end up doing more good than harm or vice versa. We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. A chance for you to ask questions of our guests about the economics of this, the regulatory aspects of it, and how much of a difference it would make in the availability and the pricing of generic drugs throughout the United States. Coming up later on in the program, the very latest on that sentencing hearing for Michael Flynn and what happened when the judge seemed to indicate it would not go well for Flynn in sentencing unless the sentencing was delayed. The defense team went ahead and took that and asked for a delay. Judge granted it. So we'll talk more about that development in court today. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Always a pleasure to be able to come on the air on Air Talk with terrific guests. And the two we have with us, prime examples of the kind of influential people in the healthcare area that we can bring you. Ovik Roy, the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. Dr. Kavita Patel, a primary care physician who practices at Johns Hopkins Medicine, but also influential advisor on healthcare policy, non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. We're talking about a bicameral bill that was introduced today by Senator Elizabeth Warren, the Democrat, and Democratic House member Jan Schakowsky, that would have the federal government either contracting for or manufacturing itself generic drugs where you've got two or fewer manufacturers and the price spikes, or generics where there's simply no company that's willing to manufacture a generic that's needed. You have questions for our guests. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Julie writes on the page, it's not this complicated. The problem is profit and greed. Remember the EpiPen debacle? The greedy price-gouging CEO of Mylan jacked up the price 400%. Just because he could. Joaquin in South LA says manufacturing insulin is cheap. Getting the FDA to approve a device comparable to the EpiPen is not. The insulin example is so infuriating, it absolutely is about the FDA. The competing thoughts of our listeners to Air Talk. Ovik Roy, back to you. Your response to Dr. Patel's point.
Well, one of your correspondents brought up the EpiPen episode. That's a classic example of where FDA regulation stymied competition. So the FDA has historically had this paradigm where in order to approve a generic competitor to a drug that is delivered through a specialized device. So EpiPen is an injectable pen that injects epinephrine, which is 110 years old in terms of it being discovered. So it's been off patent for a very long time. But the pen that Mylan manufactures, there's a patent around that. And what the FDA has required of generic competitors to EpiPen is that unless your pen delivers epinephrine in exactly the same biochemical fashion as Mylan's pen, it can't be considered generic, even if the dosage is the same, the clinical effect are the same, and the benefit to the patient is the same. That's been the historic position of the FDA, and that's the reason why there were no generic competitors to EpiPen, and EpiPen exploited that monopoly power Mylan did to charge egregious prices. So one thing that FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb has tried to do, and he's spoken about out about this while FDA Commissioner and also prior to being FDA Commissioner, he's spoken out about the need for the FDA to come up with a new regulatory pathway that certifies competitors to EpiPen that have the same clinical effect and the same dosages, right, but may not work exactly in the same way. And they've done that. They've approved the first competitor to EpiPen in that way. So that's a great example of where I wish this bill were more active in helping to create a statutory pathway for complex generics. And also, another thing that this bill could have contemplated was grants to nonprofits or other manufacturers to come in where competition is weak, instead of trying to create a new bureaucracy that may not actually succeed in providing that competition.
Norma on the page wants to get back to the saline shortage that Dr. Patel mentioned. Ovik, what's that an example of in manufacturing?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with what's going on in the saline shortage. I mean, saline is something that I would think you wouldn't even need FDA approval to deliver, but I could be mistaken about that. I mean, saline is literally just salt water, obviously in a sterilized format, but Kavita might be able to illuminate there why it is that there's a shortage in saline. But
do you know why that is?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to do with like the proprietary nature of what it is, because he's right, it's saline, but it has to do with the vials and also kind of the, I'm going to say preservative, but that may not be the accurate term, Larry, but just also the ability to kind of keep it at a certain quality, which is all of those things are regulated by the FDA. However, the issue with the saline vials most specifically is that in order to manufacture, you can imagine how many vials need to be manufactured, to do it at that scale, it's just something that the company was going to take a loss on, and that has to do, we don't have enough time to go into it.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of what's disturbing about generic drugs is not just kind of the manufacturer. It's also this like third party, these group purchasing organizations that have to get the drugs or the products like saline from the manufacturer and then sell them to the hospitals. And all it's a little bit like all these kind of intermediaries in just regular drugs that we've been talking about for months now. There are so many people that are trying to take money, and it's all causing for the end person, the patient, to have to pay more. And that's exactly kind of what we're coming back to, is that this is a conversation about affordability. That's what Senator Warren titled it, Affordable Drug Manufacturing Act.
Let's talk with George in Long Beach. George, I understand you're a physician.
That's right.
Yeah. Your thoughts on this?
Well, I think Dr. Warren, or I should say Senator Warren, has an excellent proposal, and it's in the fine, long tradition of the government stepping in to take care of something that private industry is almost intrinsically unable to handle. In fact, I'm surprised that they're not embracing this, because it'll allow them to continue the most profitable parts of manufacturing and allow the government to step in so there's no critical shortages. The big example is the saline bags. This is something that affects every single hospital across the country. And the simple reason is manufacturing and selling these wasn't as profitable as the company pursuing other things, say intravenous bags of immunoglobulin, much higher margin. You can't blame them for shifting away from saline and into something else if it makes them more money. Therefore, they should not oppose the government's plan to step in and make the saline bags until somebody else is willing to take on that book of business.
I think Ovik Roy's point, though, was if there's profit at all to be made in it, you'd have other companies that would be entering that space for the saline bags if they didn't have to go through such extensive approval hoops.
But, well, that's not a good argument, because you have to go through extensive approval hoops for every drug. The point is they have opportunities to do other drugs, hoops included, that are more profitable than the saline.
All right. Ovik, do you want to respond to George's point?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's not the existence of hoops or the absence of hoops. It's the intensity and quantity of those hoops, right? Well, I think we all agree that the FDA should have a role in ensuring the safety of our prescription drug supply, and to the degree they regulate saline bags, I think that's appropriate too. But the challenge is, can they do so and manufacture that product or drug in a way that allows them to recoup the costs of going through those hoops? That's the challenge. And so, again, we just have to make sure that we're calibrating those hoops accordingly. If we're overshooting in some areas or being redundant in some areas, we should examine that. And again,
okay.
I a flaw in this bill is that it doesn't seem to contemplate that that might even theoretically be a problem.
Dr. Kavita Patel, I want to close with you talking about what you would see, I mean, if this bill were to be passed, were to be signed into law, which would be extraordinarily uphill battle at this point. But what would you see as like the first generics that HHS could contract for or manufacture?
Insulin.
Insulin be first on the list.
Without a doubt, insulin, just given the breadth and depth of people with diabetes who need insulin and the affordability I talked about, it's no question in my mind. There are lists, though, Larry, sadly. This is actually not a list that is kept by any private citizen. The FDA actually keeps a list of shortages. There's so many critical drugs on that list, Larry, that we would be doing a service to Americans to even take like a fraction of them.
I want to thank you, Dr. Kavita Patel, Johns Hopkins Medicine, Brookings Institution, Ovik Roy Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. My thanks to you for joining us and talking about the bill introduced today in both the Senate and the House of Representatives. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Over the past couple of decades, more and more employers have experimented with a four-day work week, whether it's a 4-10, 10 hours a day, 4 days a week, or other permutations of the idea. The concept being that it makes an employer more attractive if someone could have 3 days off per week, maybe a better opportunity to balance work and home. Of course, a bit of the monkey wrench that's been thrown into this is our digital lives and the fact that for many of us in our jobs, we're pretty much on call and connected through devices to our work, regardless of time of day or night. But my question for you is, if you're someone who transitioned to a four-day work week, what were the pros and cons that you experienced? And if your employer who tried that, maybe with one or a handful of employees, what did you think of the experiment of attempting a four-day work week? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With us, someone who's researched this very issue and written about it, from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business, senior research scientist Alec Levinson. Thank you so much, sir, for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be with you.
To give us a sense of the different ways the four-day work week plays out, is the 10-4 the most common way that it's used, or are there others who are trying a 32-hour work week?
Well, so there basically are two different issues here, and I don't want to get into a long, detailed discussion about it because, you know, the listeners only have patience for so much in our busy lives these days. Bottom line is, in Europe, where people have tried to create more jobs through legislation, the idea has been floated a number of times of going from, instead of a standard 40-hour work week, down to 32. And you can do that by either, you know, cutting the workday down from 8 to 6 or from having 4 days at 8. And that's kind of the backbone behind what France has done with trying to restrict the total number of hours worked for people who aren't exempt, like you were saying. So exempt people, you can't restrict the number of hours. That's, you know, typically salaried employees. And in France, it has not had the impact that people thought it would in terms of creating more jobs. And we can certainly talk about that if people want to. In the U.S., when people talk about a four-day work week, it's what you mentioned. It's really, so rather than working your 40 hours over 4 days, you work over 5 days, you work it over 4 days. And it's not the kind of thing that people actually talk about as a way to be able to create better work-life balance. It's, you know, as you note, for a lot of people for whom, you know, you don't get paid overtime if you work more than 40 hours, there's not necessarily a benefit for your employer coming to you and saying, well, we want you to work, you know, 4 days at 10 hours a day versus 5 days at 8 hours a day. So there's a lot of complexity here, and we can. But let me just pause and, you know, got some follow up questions.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned that there's been an experiment with this. First of all, did it create more jobs in France when they tried this?
No, it didn't. And I mean, the problem comes down to that it's very hard for the government to try to kind of create jobs by mandate. It doesn't matter if you're liberal or conservative. It basically doesn't really work. So we need to think about if you're worried about, for example, people being burned out, then you need to talk about what does that look like. But people being burned out doesn't happen for people who are working 40 hours a week typically. That happens more for the salaried people like you were talking about, where you don't get paid overtime for working more than 40 hours. And whether it's you have to be in the office 50 or 60 hours, or you could be in the office 40 hours, but then have to be on call for 5 hours a day beyond that, that's what leads to burnout. It's not typically an issue we see for people who are working more in the 40-hour range. Now, for people who are working 40 hours a week where they have to be at work 6 hours, the issue for them is often work-life balance. So if we're talking about, a working family where both, both parents are working, and you've got childcare considerations or dealing with a sick relative, then being able to have the flexibility to not have to be in the office 40 hours can be helpful, but that's not something that all employers can necessarily offer.
Yeah.
It really depends on the nature of the work.
We'll continue with Alec Levinson, USC's Marshall School of Business. Again, I'd like to hear from you if you've tried a four-day-a-week work plan, either with fewer hours or still working 40 hours a week or more. How has that worked out? And if you're an employer who's tried it, what's been your experience with it? 866-893-KPCC. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the four-day work week. A lot of different versions of it. For some, it's the 10-4, 10 hours a day, 4 days a week, providing for a three-day weekend. For others, it's just cutting the hours down. 8 hours a day, 4 days a week for 32 hours a week. But there are a lot of different ways people have tried it to cut back on the commitment to actually be on site for the job and to have more time for family or personal matters. My question for you is if you've done it either on the employer side or employee side, how has that played out? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Jill in Glendale, good to have you with us.
Yes, recently I was in the hospital. This is a different permutation from the 410s. The nurses were working 312s.
Wow.
What I noticed, and I was there for a while, so I had the opportunity to, talk to nurses. And they were so fatigued by the third day, and they seemed to underperform. I mean, this was just, anecdotally from myself, what I'm saying. But I believe because there's such a shortage of nurses, that this is one of the things that the employers are offering.
As a way to recruit. Yeah, that makes sense, Jill. I appreciate that. Yeah, I've always wondered, this was something that at least was floated in law enforcement, doing three days of 12-hour shifts. And I was just wondering, as you say, by the end of the third day, working 36 hours in a three-day period of time, how exhausted someone would be, whether nursing, law enforcement, or any kind of a job. Alec Levinson, has that been researched?
Well, so Larry, so there's a really important point here. You said, offering 312 is a way to kind of make it attractive. I actually think that isn't about making the job attractive to the people working in it. This is dealing with the realities of trying to schedule a 24/7 workforce. So in nursing, in police work, particularly for people police on patrol, you need to have people 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And because of the problems of recruiting people and getting them to work graveyard shifts, like overnight, this sounds like that it's one way to solve it, where you basically say to people, if you want to work in this job, if you want to be a nurse here, if you want to be a police person, then you have to work in these 12-hour shifts. It's a way to solve the scheduling problem, but it does not have great impacts in terms of people being tired and potentially their job performance. I mean, the one place where this tends to be used, I wouldn't say 312, but you talk about like 410. Think about places like an oil rig where you have to be taking workers by helicopter.
Yeah, go to it.
Long distances, right? I mean, so in those kinds of situations, it's very difficult to be staffing like, you know, three shifts a day. So you might do this where you have people working really intensively for a short time and coming back.
Yeah, because of all the time in transit. That's an excellent. Right. And you're living on site, kind of like firefighters. You're living at your job. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Gary in Manhattan Beach says, I have a rental company with 30 employees, and it doesn't work for us. When you have a small business, you're driven by your customers. You have to be open, not just 5 days a week, but beyond. So you're constantly working to the schedule of your clients. Elizabeth in Los Alamitos says a four-day work week works really well when you have a mix of shift workers working together as a team, working in different 8 or 10 hour shifts. It allows the company not have to pay overtime and allows employees to have better schedules. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. David, in Santa Monica, what's your experience with the four-day week?
So the way it worked for me when I worked at the Jeff Paulson Laboratory was that we got put on RDOs, so every 2 weeks you get a day off. And the way we did that is working an extra hour every day. And that was great for me, but the reality is that it wasted a lot.
David, you still there? No. Are you there?
Can't hear me.
Yeah, go ahead. I can hear you now.
That it wastes a lot of money because I didn't do a lot of work for 9 hours. I could get my work done in about six. So we sit there twiddling our thumbs.
Okay. So the workload wasn't customized to the longer work day to do that. David, I appreciate it. But I bet it was nice to have a three-day weekend every other week. That sounds like a pretty nice perk. 866-893-KPECC. Kelsey in San Pedro, what's your experience with the four-day week?
I worked in drug and alcohol in a drug and alcohol treatment center, and I transitioned from working 5 8-hour days to 4 10-hour days, and I loved it. The nature of the work was pretty emotional and emotionally draining, but I didn't really notice the extra 2 hours added on to my shift didn't make it any more difficult for me. I loved having a three-day weekend every week. I have family that's within driving distance, so it made it such that I could go visit them. My days off happened to be in the middle of the week, so if I needed to schedule a doctor's appointment, it was super easy, or, you know, going to the grocery store.
Yeah, well, I would think also from an emotional standpoint, because as you mentioned, the emotional demand of working in the rehab sector, to have 3 days to sort of, you know, get yourself back, that also had to be emotionally beneficial.
Oh, definitely. It helped me not bring my work home.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, you could take more time to decompress. It makes a lot of sense. Kelsey, thank you for your call. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Rob in Mid-Wilshire, your thoughts on the four-day work week?
You know, in the mid-1970s, they were debating this at UC campuses, at Berkeley, at MIT, at Princeton. And what was driving it as a student, as my recollection, is that the transportation economist said, get these cars off the road at peak rush hours, will improve the effective capacity of the highways, the bridges. And people like Lloyd Ullman at the Institute of Industrial Relations at Berkeley, his faculty assistants, you know, their study was, well, there are a lot of social benefits for this. I really think that what was driving this was not the social benefits of providing a more flexible life, but rather a lot of transportation economists looked and said this is an obvious way to get people on the road, yeah, get them home.
Well, and of course, in Los Angeles, where our rush hour is most of the day, I'm not sure that would make much difference. But Alec Levinson of USC, this sort of speaks to how long this has been out there as a proposal to address a variety of concerns.
Well, it is. Although, Larry, I would, being somebody who's lived in L.A. for a quarter century, I'll take the other side of that argument from you, which is, if people are having to fight traffic 5 days a week, and if the option is to only do it 4 days a week, and besides, like, you almost can't work an 8-hour day and drive any distance in this city And if you're doing it either in the morning or evening at the peak of rush hour, you're literally like typically having to travel twice as long. So if instead I could choose to be 4 days in the office, leave a couple hours later so the traffic is probably lighter, I mean, overall, I'm probably spending a lot less time on the road to the point of the previous caller.
Yeah, no, it's a big – I could definitely see that as a big advantage. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll continue our conversation with senior research scientist with USC's Center for Effective Organizations, Alec Levinson, and we'll take your calls. I'm really interested in hearing if you're an employer who tried going to a four-day work week or uses a four-day work week for your staff – how has that worked? What are the pros and cons? 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. The four-day work week, whether it's a four-day a week, 10-hour a day, or just cutting back on total hours, providing more hours to spend with family, friends, or on personal projects. We're at 866-893. I'd like to hear what your experience is. It's been good hearing from people, employees who've tried it. I'd love to hear from those of you that are employers what your perspective is on this. 866-893-KPECC. To Alec Levinson, our guest, Point Chris in Huntington Beach says, I work four 10-hour days. I commute to North Hollywood. And working 4 days has reduced my travel time by 4 hours a week. It's allowed me to spend more time with my family and to spend more time researching my own career. That's Chris in Huntington Beach. Chris, thanks so much. And Margaret in Pasadena says, I'm a nurse who works 12-hour shifts. The caller who was a patient and was concerned that nurses get tired by the end of a third straight day of 12-hour shifts said, typically, nurses don't work three straight 12-hour shifts, usually no more than two in a row. And the 12-hour shift provides continuity of care. I think that's a positive. That's Margaret's comment. Margaret in Pasadena, a nurse, sharing her perspective. Elvira in Monrovia says, I'm a teacher at LA Unified. The four-day work week wouldn't be possible for us when the district is on break. Traffic is dramatically reduced. Taking people off the road day one a week would be great. Yeah, I don't think we're going to see schools go to a four-day work week. And obviously, education employs thousands and thousands of people. 866-893-KPECC. Ryan in downtown Los Angeles, what's your experience working a 410?
Well, I work for a coffee roasting company, and when I started there, it was 2.5 years ago, and we worked, the standard 5-day, 8-hour work week. And it was about 6 to 7 months after I started, we switched over to a 10-hour a day, 4-day work week. And man, I'll tell you, it changed my quality of life for the better in ways that I just I'm so thankful for, because our company gave us the option to vote on it or vote for it as a staff. And we all agreed that we would love to try it. You know, you get 3 days off every week, and I'm a musician.
Oh, perfect.
You know, so I have a lot of different projects that I've got going on. I get called for recordings and gigs all the time. And it's so good to have that extra day off every single week.
Makes sense. Plus, Ryan, you're roasting coffee beans, so presumably you have Java available to keep you going the ninth and tenth hours of those days. Ryan, I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC. Rick in Tustin says, I'm an employer, and I thought you had to pay overtime if someone works more than an 8-hour day. I have an architectural firm. Can I have people work more than 8 hours a day with that schedule? Alec Levinson of USC, do you know about the law on that?
Yeah, I figured you'd ask me. So I'm not a labor lawyer, and I'm whatever I say will probably be incorrect. But I do think that there are situations where At least there have been times in the past, and California may be different, and it varies from state to state. But there are situations in which you can actually have people work for, you know, essentially like 4 10-hour days without having to pay overtime. But again, it might be different now in California than it used to be.
All right. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You know, Richard Branson wrote an essay, I believe it was published yesterday, in which he said, we're going to have to get used to people working less as automation and robotics take more and more jobs. The only way it's going to work from an economic standpoint is people to work fewer hours, but essentially making, you know, living wages at the same time that they work less. He said, I think we can accomplish that, though it's going to be challenging. Alec Levinson, do you think that is a workable challenge?
And Richard Branson is really expert on a lot of things around business, but he's a little misguided on this one. People with every wave of automation that's come in historically over time, people worry about jobs disappearing and, you know, is it the end of work? And we're hearing it again around AI and all these new innovations. And the reality is that for the most part, you know, if we have people who want to work, there are jobs available for them. Now, how much those jobs pay, you know, how hard you have to work, where are they located, all that. That speaks to quality of life. It speaks to how, you know, how high standard of living people can have. But broadly speaking, from an economy-wide perspective, no. When automation like that happens, it's not, you know, we're not looking at the end of work and people having to work less.
Greg in Chinatown says, my wife and I considered a 4-day work week, but from the parental standpoint, we were trying to figure out if we could save money on childcare if it was 3 versus 5 days a week. But we found there really wasn't a cost saving in cutting the professional daycare down to 3 days a week. So interesting to hear about the, you know, different things people are looking at as a way to deal with that. Let's see. Andre writes on the page, I work for a global delivery company. Our operations are 24 hours a day in metropolitan areas. I gladly work 4 13-hour days or even 4 14-hour days instead of 5 12-hour days that I currently work. Andre, that's got to be exhausting. Be careful out there driving around working for that delivery company. Finally, Alec Levinson, do you think that the momentum is on the side of expanding 4-day work weeks or not?
From an kind of a formal perspective, I wouldn't say there's a huge amount of momentum. And we've heard a lot of examples here of there's lots of types of work where it just can't be done. And also, for some people who might want the 4-day work week, others wouldn't. So I love the example of the coffee roaster where they let the employees choose. I'm guessing, though, the vote wasn't, you know, 100% in favor and 0% against. There's always people who, you know, want things different ways. And so because of that, there's never one right solution. And, you know, and when it comes to education, when it comes to a lot of these other kinds of jobs, you can't necessarily make it only a 4-day week where, you know, people can just have a different person fill in on the 5th day. So it's a challenge, but always, I mean, it's good for companies to think about, you know, different ways that they can approach doing things, because you can get kind of set in your ways. And it's important to have these conversations, both, you know, in terms of what the company can do, but also talking to people who are working for you in terms of what they want.
It's funny because when I was a kid in school, I remember teachers talking about how, oh, when you're grown, you probably people will be working much less. You'll have much more leisure time, and the regular week maybe, you know, 4 days a week, people working less. Like flying cars, it doesn't seem like that's happened. Same promise unmet by my teachers. Alec Levinson, thank you so much. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Larry.
Alec Levinson, senior research scientist at the Center for Effective Organizations, USC's Marshall School of Business. William in Villa Park says, I've been doing a 4-day work week for 40 years as a dentist. I did it because we'd get a lot of cancellation. We decided to eliminate one day. My staff gets to work a full day without tiring out. That's the advantage. You can share your comments about the four-day work week on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We have a lot more to come in our second hour of AirTalk, including LGBTQ as a terminology. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I'm a little shy about promoting segments coming up later this hour. We have so many moving parts that in case I have to move something to another day, I'm reluctant. But I think I can assure you Kyle Stokes, KPCC, K-12 education reporter, will be with us to talk about part of the dispute between LA Unified and teachers being resolved, only part of the dispute, but it's a major component. We'll talk about that coming up in just a few minutes. First, this sounds so dull to put it this way, that the judge put off the sentencing of Michael Flynn in the case of him pleading guilty to lying to FBI investigators about his contact with Russian government officials. But it was anything but a dull proceeding. With us to talk about what transpired in D.C. federal court this morning, Darren Samuelson, White House reporter for Politico. Darren, thank you for joining us. What a morning.
Good afternoon. Yeah, it was quite a shocking turn of events.
So, first of all, before much got started, it sounded like the judge had some pretty damning things to say about Flynn.
Yeah, that's right. So this is U.S. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan, appointed by President Bill Clinton, who didn't initially accept the guilty plea. He wasn't the first judge on this case, but he later took over the case. And you could tell as he was sort of working his way through the details, he was, you know, maybe a little bit kind of learning as he went. And so he was quite, I would say, harsh on Michael Flynn for everything that Flynn pleaded guilty to back in December of 2017. He seemed to imply that he was a traitor to the country and he was serving in a really high capacity as you know, Donald Trump's national security advisor, and insulted the flag by the work that he had done by lying to the FBI and also not being registered as a foreign agent, which he later recognized he actually made a couple of mistakes in the lambasting that he did in public in front of General Flynn. But nonetheless, really let him have it at the beginning of the court hearing this morning.
The judge saying, I can't hide my disgust, my disdain at the crime that's involved. Nonetheless, the judge seemed to signal to the defense that you probably want to delay the sentencing given the ongoing cooperation of their client, General Flynn, with federal investigators, part of the Mueller probe. So did this result from the defense filing as well, where they were alleging that Flynn was not encouraged to have an attorney present during that conversation where he lied about his meeting with the Russian government official and the like? Did it seem that that some of this came out of that filing?
Well, that was actually the first part of the hearing where the judge was bringing up that. And he put that in front of Michael Flynn and said, is this why you want, or would you consider, or are you interested in postponing your sentence because of this? And Flynn actually said, no, Your Honor, I'm actually ready to proceed. And then it was sort of on a second set of topics to what you just brought up, the cooperation that he's continuing to provide as a part of this case. And it is very common when there is sentencing done that you wait until all of the cooperation is finished in order to finally do the sentence. Now, there are ways to wiggle around that, and you can go ahead and update a sentence afterwards. But like an example with Michael Cohen, who was sentenced last week to 3 years in prison, but does continue to cooperate. They did move ahead in that case. Here, the judge said, look, I think that you might want to wait. I might be not obliged to take what the Mueller team had recommended, which was a light prison sentence Mueller's team was recommending. Flynn's attorneys were saying no prison sentence at all. And the judge was sort of hinting that he might impose something much harsher. And he said, look, if you want to wait and you want to cooperate and continue to help the Mueller team, you want to help other U.S. prosecutors. There's this other case that was just filed or unsealed on Monday in a district court in Virginia involving some of Flynn's former business partners who it sounds like Michael Flynn would be called to testify if there is a trial there. The judge said, look, if you want to wait and hold off until all that's done and then do the sentencing, I'm okay with that. There was this dramatic pause for about 30 minutes while the Flynn team considered it. And then they came back and said, yeah, you know what, Your Honor, we'll take you up on that offer. Let's postpone this for a couple more months. And so that's where we are right now.
And there's no future date. This is open-ended?
There is a date in the beginning of March where they will check back in with a joint filing. So there's actually no hearing yet scheduled. But I believe they said March 6th, if I remember correctly, is when the Flynn lawyers and the Mueller team will get back to the judge with their next filing, indicating when the sentencing date should be. At that point, we will have seen transpire some of the early proceedings in the case in Virginia, maybe get a little bit better sense of whether there's going to be a trial, whether the defendants are going to plead guilty or not guilty. But also, you know, Flynn is cooperating in seemingly other cases, too. And I believe at that point they'll make a sense. They'll give us some sort of a sense of when where they want to go forward. And I should correct myself. I said March 6th. I believe it's March 13th is the date.
March 13th. Okay, great. Darren, I know you got to run. Thank you. I know you're on tight deadline. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Darren Samuelson joining us from Politico, where he's senior White House reporter. The White House press briefing is also underway right now. Lori Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and former federal prosecutor, also joins us. Professor, always a pleasure. Your thoughts about the development today in federal court?
Well, you know, I think people are a little bit surprised because I don't think we expected it to be continued. The Flynn team's ready to go. But I do think they were startled, as your last speaker said, by what the judge was saying. The judge seemed to throw out words that were very harsh. It may turn out in the end that the bark is worse than the bite, but there's certainly now more of a message to the defense team that cooperation is important, but this crime was very serious.
Now, this, if I'm not mistaken, is the same judge who presided in the Ted Stevens Alaska corruption allegation in which the government's case sort of fell apart, as I recalled, over its methodology. Wasn't he the same guy who was on the bench for that?
He was the same judge on the Ted Stevens corruption case. And if we recall, that's a case where it ended up where the prosecutors themselves were charged with withholding exculpatory information. And there were very tragic results. I think one of the prosecutors ended his own life when it came to light. And there were repercussions to the Department of Justice. So this is a judge who's harsh in both directions. He wants a fair case, but when it happens, he's going to treat it seriously. And I think he was doing a lot of messaging in the courtroom today.
And do you think it was at all out of bounds for the judge to say the highly critical things that he did? Or is that part of when a judge feels that way, is that a good thing to be so candid?
Well, that's part of what sentencing is and should be all about. It's not just a, you know, quick operation. Here's your sentence. Go on your way. I think it is a time for the court to send a message not just to this defendant, but to the community as well, because the public is ultimately the victim of this crime. And so we see judges, some are more vocal than others, some are harsher than others, but the judge knows that everybody's looking, and they're going to judge, hey, is this a serious crime? When the Flynn folks say it doesn't really count because he wasn't warned that he, you know, had to tell the truth, the judge had something to say about that through his words as well.
Professor, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. Anything else just that stood out to you about the way things unfolded?
I think what's interesting here is that this judge, and I expect others, really want to see how far this will go. You know, Trump is now surrounded by people who have pled guilty and are facing sentencing. Flynn spent time in the campaign and in the White House. He is the transitional witness, and he had contact with the Russian authorities. So maybe there is collusion, maybe there's not. But a person who's going to give them some good information and leads is probably Mike Flynn.
Professor, thank you so much. Lori Levinson, Loyola Law School, former federal prosecutor before joining the academy. In major national news today, it appears President Trump is backing off of his demand for funding in the continuing resolution to fund the government for a border wall between Mexico and the U.S. White House reporter for Politico, Gabby Orr, is with us. Gabby, thanks so much. What seems to be the changing message from the administration?
Well, the White House did certainly appear to make a pretty big concession this morning in their push to get that $5 billion figure in wall funding. They sent dispatched Press Secretary Sarah Sanders to do a Fox News interview, during which she said that there were other avenues they could take in order to sort of cobble together that $5 billion figure, that they don't necessarily need this in an add-on to the spending package that is being negotiated right now on Capitol Hill. That is in stark contrast to what the president has said over the past week. Sarah Sanders said that they don't want to shut down the government. They don't even want a partial shutdown. President Trump said less than a week ago that he would be proud to shut the government down if it meant securing that border security and border wall funding. So it does seem like a major walk back from the White House this morning. I'm sure we're hearing more right now as Sanders briefs reporters at the White House. And we can expect to see some developments probably later this afternoon, if not tomorrow morning, on the direction of these negotiations, whether they're heading toward a temporary stopgap measure or if there is going to be a year-long funding package.
You're probably doing what I am, looking out the corner of your eye at the news conference where the lower thirds on the screen says, according to Sarah Sanders, every agency is being asked for money to build the wall. Do you have any sense of what that means? And would that just be like across the board kind of cutbacks or other agencies that might relate to immigration or border enforcement where they'd come up with the money?
Yeah, they've looked at the budgets for different agencies and operations within the government, and they think that they can sort of pull together this $5 billion figure by making cuts here and there to programs that are perhaps not as necessary as border security, or at least that's what they seem to be arguing. The bill would still include at least some funding for repairs to the current border infrastructure, to the current fencing and walls that do already exist along the border. We just put out a piece this morning on Politico that said that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had spoken to Democratic leaders about a funding bill that would include the $1.6 billion figure for fencing and an additional $1 billion for spending that Trump could put towards a border wall or some barrier, which is obviously something that Democrats have been resistant to. But
yeah.
$1 billion is certainly less than $5 billion, and it might be more appealing to them.
Gabby, I need to break, but real quickly, does this look like the government then will not do a limited shutdown on Friday?
I think we're heading toward a deal of some kind before
All right.
Friday's deadline.
Gabby Orr, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
White House reporter for Politico with the very latest on those negotiations. It's Air Talk on KPCC, and we're just a minute away from a bill that's been introduced in Sacramento that would limit gun ownership for those convicted of alcohol-related crimes. Is this something that would cut down on gun violence without intruding into constitutional protections? We'll talk about that in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, member of the California State Senate. Hannah Beth Jackson of Santa Barbara has introduced a bill that would limit gun sales. If someone has been convicted of certain alcohol-related crimes, they would be banned from purchasing a firearm for a decade. With us is Amanda Wilcox, legislative advocate for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence's California chapters. Amanda, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
So share with us which particular alcohol-related crimes under this bill would potentially keep someone from being able to purchase a gun.
Of course, the common alcohol crime that most people are aware of is driving under the influence of alcohol. So if a person has two DUI convictions within a three-year period, the bill would cause a 10-year firearm prohibition. Public intoxication also could be a reason. Vehicle manslaughter while intoxicated, or causing injury while driving under the influence of alcohol. So in other words, active alcohol abusers who've had repeated convictions for alcohol-related offenses would have a 10-year firearm prohibition.
And this is based on the research showing that those who have been convicted of certain alcohol-related convictions are at increase of committing a firearm-related crime?
Yes, there's a 4 to 5 times greater likelihood that people with these convictions, alcohol-related convictions, are at risk of future acts of violence and of misuse of firearms. So I should just back up a little bit about the Brady campaign. You know, our core goal is to keep dangerous weapons out of dangerous hands. And there is broad consensus, I would say, and support for background checks on firearm sales so that people with either past behavior or condition that indicates that their risk of future acts of violence don't have access to firearms. In this case, alcohol abusers, I would say it's both a past behavior, a DUI, and perhaps an condition related to alcohol that shows that they are at greater risk of violence. And so, and the research clearly supports that. We like to do research-based policies in California. And so this really is a good fit for what our primary goal is, which is dangerous weapons out of dangerous hands.
Amanda Wilcox of the Brady Campaign joining us. Also with us, Craig DeLuz, who is Director of Legislative and Public Affairs for the Firearms Policy Coalition, a gun rights organization. Thank you, Craig, for being with us. What are your concerns about this bill?
Well, you know, we have in the United States, we have certain crimes for which if you are going to lose your fundamental, your constitutional rights, we have certain crimes that are serious enough that warrant that. In the United States, we call those felonies. And under felonies, you do lose your right to keep and bear arms when convicted of a felony. If we are going to continue to expand the number of misdemeanors, once again, misdemeanors are supposed to be minor crimes. More and more, what you're going to wind up having is there. It seems like this is an opportunity to expand the list of the number of people who are going to not be able to own firearms, since in fact they can't just ban firearms.
But what about the association between those who are convicted of alcohol-related misdemeanors and potential use of a firearm in committing a crime? What's your response to this would be something that could make the state safer?
Well, understand this. First of all, it's not about those who are convicted of alcohol-related misdemeanors. It's alcohol-related crimes in general. Oftentimes, individuals will plead guilty to a misdemeanor because they don't want a felony on their record. So in many cases, and in understanding that over 95% of all crimes are not actually – there's not actually a court case where someone is convicted, where someone actually goes to trial – I can literally say this, 9 times out of 10, it's a plea bargain that is struck. And because in the state of California, we don't have any requirement that individuals are told exactly what you're giving up, in particular with misdemeanor plea bargains, what you lose when you do so, many people may choose to accept a plea simply because it's cheaper and more inexpensive than actually going to court. And we just believe that people are going to unknowingly be giving up their constitutional right to keep and bear arms.
Also, Mr. DeLuz, what about the constitutional issues here? Do you think that if this passes, it would be ripe for constitutional challenge?
Well, we do, because in essence, what we're talking about here is pre-crime. You are now trying to penalize people for something that is unrelated. In other words, we're going to determine based on a certain set of circumstances that you are dangerous enough to where you should lose your rights. If we're going to look at situations where one is, well, one could say, well, if you are an African-American male under the age of 25 living in an urban community, you are more likely to engage in gun violence. Therefore, you should not be able to own a gun. Or if you are a white male over the age of 55 living in certain rural communities, you are more likely to commit suicide. Therefore, we should take away your right to keep and bear arms. If you are a female and you are purchasing a gun, you are more likely to be a straw buyer. Therefore, we should take away your right to keep and bear arms.
Of course, if you were talking about race or ethnicity or gender, there would be pretty clear discriminatory aspects of this. But let me turn the principle. Let's say, Amanda Wilcox, that you found an association, hypothetically, between shoplifting and using a gun in the commission of a violent crime. Would you still think, okay, we've got an association here, those are the people we should go after because as a group they have a higher propensity to commit gun violence?
In general, yes. I support, if the evidence is there that this population is at greater risk, then I think a temporary prohibition should be considered. And remember, this is about people who've committed a crime. It's not saying people who drink alcohol in their home, even if they, are extreme drinkers in their home. If they're not causing danger to others, if they're not driving while under the influence or doing a public intoxication where they're creating problems on a public street, this law is not going to impact them. This is about people who have committed a crime, who have been convicted of a crime, and moreover, they've done it twice within 3 years. So someone got a DUI, maybe they did the plea deal, as Craig alludes to, but that wouldn't cause a prohibition. It's having another one in 3 years. And if someone didn't learn from the first DUI experience and they show the irresponsibility of driving again under the influence, I would question their level of responsibility and the appropriateness of.
But I think what Craig's.
Remember, these are offenses they've committed. It's not just behavior. It's
but
crime.
I think.
With it.
Yeah, but I think Craig's point is you're banning something for an individual. You don't know that individual person is at any risk whatsoever of committing a firearm crime because that person is driven drunk. The same way of any other crime that you'd say you can't have a gun because, you shoplifted, for example, where there's not a direct correlation. Obviously, if you're convicted of a gun crime, then that's direct. But if you're talking about drinking or if you're talking about property crimes, that's an indirect link. So his point is why would you take away the individual right of the person because they're part of a higher risk group? Is that constitutionally right?
Well, we certainly do that in other cases. Though we recently enacted a law that those with who've been convicted of a hate crime misdemeanor would also have a 10-year prohibition. We have a number of crimes that are associated with a 10-year firearm prohibition, a temporary prohibition for any of those policies. It is a broad brush for a group that's considered higher risk. Within that group, as individuals, of course, there may be people who don't show that same risk. But in terms of public health, we have to look at broader groups and rates in the data rather than individually, and that is the public health approach.
Craig DeLuz, just real quickly.
If worried about their gun rights, then I would suggest that they, watch their behavior after a first offense and not have a second offense.
Craig DeLuz, if this passes, you anticipate there'll be lawsuits against it?
I'm not sure if there would or there would not be. Obviously, our attorneys are taking a look at it. This is just one more incident where they figure they can't ban guns, so they're going to try and restrict the number of people who can get access to guns. We know that this is a slippery slope, and unfortunately, when it comes to gun laws, and in particular in the state of California, we know that this is, at the very least, the camel's nose under the tent.
All right. Craig DeLuz.
They will do whatever they can to expand the list of people from whom they can take gun rights. And unfortunately, that just seems to be where folks like Senator Jackson are.
Firearms Policy Coalition Legislative Public Affairs Director Craig J. DeLuz, Amanda Wilcox, Legislative Advocate, the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. KPCC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes was just recently on the air with us talking about this important fact-finding process in mediation between the L.A. Unified School District and its teachers union, UTLA. That report has now come back, and there's an announcement of at least a partial agreement between teachers and the district. Kyle, good morning. What can you share with us?
Yeah, absolutely, Larry. Good to be with you. So what happened today was that there was a report. This, as you mentioned, the fact finder came back with the recommendations for settling this long-running dispute between UTLA and LAUSD. Now, this dispute essentially, you know, has revolved around two big issues: salaries and class sizes. The fact finder, this neutral third party, came in and recommended that the district's offer of a 6% raise for the teachers be accepted. So that's 3% back pay, 3% ongoing raise for the district's teachers union members. Now, what the district came out and said today was that UTLA essentially agrees with this offer and is fine with it. I've reached out to the union to just make sure that that's in fact the case and haven't yet got an official response. Okay. So that was one. But you know, the district is certainly saying we have, you know, sort of this issue is ironed out. And to be fair, Larry, they weren't that far apart on this issue. The union wanted 6.5%. They wanted it all retroactive. The district wanted to give them 6%. The fact finder essentially said, take the district's offer, but lop up some of the strings that the district had attached to it. The other thing, though, was that the fact finder weighed in on was class sizes. And the fact finder said that the union is right, that the district should get rid of a provision in the contract that allows LAUSD to have a lot of flexibility to raise class sizes whenever it wants. Now, the district has said they are willing to get rid of it. They are willing to renegotiate it, but they haven't found a willing negotiating partner in the union in trying to figure out what should replace the provision that the union has worked so long to strike from the contract.
In funding that, Kyle, does the fact finder recommend what sort of money would be identified to fund smaller class sizes?
They don't talk about identifying funding sources other than saying that the district and the union should get together and go to Sacramento and advocate for these issues. That is sort of what the district's argument is at this point. And by the way, the union has also said that they would like to do that.
Yeah, I mean, but that's sort of you know, hopeful that Sacramento would bail them out on that issue. It doesn't really resolve the impasse if there's no additional state dollars.
Right. I mean, well, this is what the district's argument has been all along, that we don't have the money to solve this problem. Now, this has been, I was mentioning when I was on the show the other day, Larry, I mean, that there is still this sort of central dispute over what the state of the district's finances are. Now, the union is saying, well, the fact finder has affirmed what we have been saying all along, which is that there's $1.8 billion in reserve. Now, when you read the report, it notes that the fact finder does note the district has $1.8 billion in reserve. But the district has been making the case for a long time that when the union says this, it makes it sound like the district is sitting on this big pile of cash and refusing to spend it. The district contends we are planning to spend almost every single dollar of this reserve in order to stay in the black for the next 3 years. And after the next 3 years, the district is going to drop into the red. The district is spending between $300 to $500 million a year more than what it's taking in. I mean, the district is saying we are spending this reserves. So when the union says $1.8 billion in reserve, it's a little bit misleading. The fact finder doesn't exactly weigh in on the current state of the district's budget. And that may be where some of the money for some of these the provisions that you're talking about, Larry, might be hiding.
That, to me, was really sort of the thing I was looking forward to was the fact finder addressing, you know, resolving that issue. Should that money be held, as LAUSD says, for, you know, future funding allocations to which they say they're committed, or should that money be freed up to reduce class size, hire nurses and mental health employees? So what's your thought, bottom line, on this, Kyle? Do you think this does anything to lessen the chances of a strike next month? Kyle?
You cut out there for a second my end there, Larry. Sorry.
So bottom line, does this diminish, do you think, the chances of a strike next month or not necessarily change the equation?
I think it's going to depend on the reaction of the union at this point. And I'm still waiting for the union's response to what the district is saying. The district, I think it's safe to say, feels very vindicated by this. The district says they are open to negotiations over the winter break. But it largely goes back to the union. The ball is essentially in the union's court at this point. That's not just what the district is saying. That's sort of a matter of fact. It's up to the district, to the union now, with this fact-finding report is being out. It's up to them whether they want to strike, because there's nothing legally preventing them from doing so. The question is, do they come to the table with the district too?
Kyle, as always, appreciate it. I know you're working on this, getting it set to go on LAist.com, and also reporting on the air here at KPCC as the day goes on. Thanks very much.
You bet.
KPCC K-12 education reporter Kyle Stokes joining us on Air Talk. Coming up, what's the best term to use to refer to non-heterosexual individuals, gender-conforming individuals? What's the best umbrella term for the sector of the population? We'll talk about that after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Back when Air Talk started, when we were referring to someone who wasn't heterosexual, we would just use the term gay. That was sort of the generic term that included gay men and lesbians. And then, of course, terminology changed and became more specific, using the terms gay men and lesbian. Since that time, transgender Americans, gender nonconforming individuals, others have gone under the umbrella heading of LGBTQ, but it's rather unwieldy to use that acronym, particularly in broadcast. And I was actually thinking about this, and I was thinking, you know, what would be a better umbrella term? I was thinking about queer as a possibility, but something that would be a much shorter way of talking about someone who falls into one of those categories that LGBTQ covers. My question for you is, what would that umbrella term be? What would be an easier way of talking about individuals that are not in the heterosexual or what's thought of as typical gender identities of male or female? We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Also thinking about this issue from The Atlantic, contributing editor Jonathan Rausch, who said it's time to drop the LGBT from LGBTQ. He's at the Brookings Institution, a senior fellow in governance studies. Jonathan, good to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Larry. Thanks.
So you've obviously given this a lot of thought. And what are some of the different things you thought about, alternatives for a shorter way of describing the group?
Well, not just shorter. I think also you send a better message when you get away from these long strings of identity politics initials that kind of emphasize you got a whole bunch of these different groups with different claims and you've got to be intersectional and deal with them all separately. I think that's a flawed claim, and I think we're seeing some backlash against it in the Trump era. So I asked myself, well, how about going back to the original idea of the founders of the gay rights movement, Frank Kameny, who said just gay for everybody. That's fine. Well, that doesn't really work anymore because it's gendered these days. You know, people do distinguish gay from lesbian. And then, of course, you've got lots of these other groups. And I said, well, how about just keep it simple? How about just one letter, Q? Doesn't need to even stand for anything. In LGBTQ, some people think the Q means queer. Some people think it means questioning. It doesn't even need to mean anything. It can just be a way to refer to sexual minorities and their friends who believe in equal rights for all Americans.
All right. So just using Q, when you use just an initial like that, though, doesn't it sort of raise the question, well, then what does it stand for?
Doesn't need to. I think it just means sexual minorities and equal rights. I think as individuals, you know, I'm a gay man and I'll continue to refer to myself that way. And I think trans people and lesbians and bi people and so forth will also continue to refer to themselves as whatever they feel their identity is. But when we need to talk about the population as a whole, the sexually nonconforming population, it would be handy to have just a simple way to indicate that, that really doesn't have to indicate anything else. You know, it could be some other letter. It could be, you know, N or whatever. But Q is handy, and it's kind of cool and nifty.
And why Q over queer as an example? Because we are talking about, as you said, minorities within gender and sexuality. Why not queer?
Queer's been around now for 30, 40 years. And I admire queer because it was an effort, largely successful, to take back this term of derision and repurpose it and take ownership of it. But it hasn't caught on with the general public. It's still got some fairly radical overtones. Lots of gay and lesbian people are not comfortable with it. In fact, pushback on my idea of Q has come from two directions, ironically. They're opposite directions. One is people who think, well, Q is just queer and we reject queer, so we reject Q. And the other is people who say, well, no, Q loses L, G, B, and T. So we reject it because it loses those other letters. So kind of a no-win situation.
So do they have a better idea?
No one has a better idea. And, you know, what's interesting, Larry, is having published this article just a few days ago, but watching the Twitter feed and the dialogue, a lot of people out there are not super happy with LGBTQIAA+. Which is one of the many acronyms. I think a lot of people sense that this is all getting a little bit ridiculous and that we're not doing ourselves justice when we insist on kind of roping together these long strings of initials. It's not a great message to send about our posture in American life.
Now, you used another term just a couple minutes ago. I hadn't heard. What did you say? Sexual minorities or what? You used a term that could be used as an umbrella term.
Yeah, I sometimes use sexual minorities myself when I write and speak about this because it's a very neutral term and it does describe everybody who deals with these realities of discrimination and nonconformity. The problem is you can't use it in a lot of situations where you need to be able to use it. You can't use it as an adjective. You'd have to, you know, I'm sexual minority-ish. I'm a member of a sexual minority. Doesn't really work in the situations where LGBTQ works. It's also kind of academic-y and weird, and it's not a personal identifier. I can't see myself saying, hi, I'm Jonathan, I'm a member of sexual minorities. Q works everywhere. LGBTQ works. I just say, hi, I'm Jonathan Rauch. And if I don't feel like saying I'm gay, I say I'm Q or, you know, I'm a member of the Q community.
But if you're talking about an individual, then you could use the more specific descriptor, right?
Well, that's exactly the point. No one needs to feel they have to be dragged through a set of initials. They can describe themselves as however they identify themselves. But when they need an umbrella term, you know, for a sentence like, we believe in the continued march toward equality for America's Q community, you have a way to do that that just communicates the message very simply and without all the divisiveness.
Again, I'd love to hear from you as an AirTalk listener. What do you think would be the best way to refer as a group to sexual minorities, whether they're gay men, lesbians, bisexual Americans, transgender people, those who call themselves queer, questioning individuals, 866-893-KPECC. And how do you refer to yourself? If you're talking about the larger group, what expression do you use? Do you only use a highly specific one, saying, for example, I'm bisexual or I'm bi or I'm trans? Or do you use the larger group umbrella? And if you do, which one do you use? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, KPECC.org. Norma writes on the page, what about rainbow people or rainbow person? All right, 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, Emily Blunt, the star of Mary Poppins Returns, that's coming up. She's also in A Quiet Place, a critically acclaimed film that she did with her husband earlier this year. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. What do you think is the best term, or what term do you use if you are in the LGBTQ communities? What term do you think is the best umbrella term? Obviously, you've got specific references, gay man, lesbian, bi, transgender. But what about an all-encompassing word? With us, contributing editor of The Atlantic, Jonathan Rauch, he's advocating for Q. Just drop the rest of the initials in LGBTQ. See, that's a problem. I can't even say it right. And just use Q, 866-893-KPCC. Glenn O. writes on the page, I hate the use of nonconforming. It suggests something irrelevant to innate sexual orientation. We don't speak of nonconforming of races or even nonconforming religions. Do straight folks call themselves conforming? James says, please don't refer to me as cisgender. James says, well, how about homosexual? James, that would only apply to gay men and lesbian. It wouldn't apply to other groups. JSK writes on the page, soth, sexuality other than heterosexual. 866-893-KPCC. But of course, you have trans individuals who can be heterosexual or can be gay or lesbian. So soth wouldn't identify all trans people. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Let's talk with Josh in Long Beach. You're on AirTalk.
Hello. Hi. I just want to make sure to clarify. The guest is using the term sexual minority. And as you just referred to, that doesn't differentiate between sexuality and gender, which the LGBTQ community encompasses. So I just wanted to make that distinction.
No, that's a good point. So I guess what would you think, Josh, about sexual and gender minority? But then it's gender identity you're really talking about. Then you're getting complicated again.
Exactly.
All right. Okay, Josh, thanks. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Chris in Pacific Palisades, what's your suggestion?
Hey, Larry, I respectfully disagree with Q, which we all know is a well-known Star Trek character. I really think it's time to have a human term. And so for me, my suggestion is alt-cool. Alt-cool, because I'm alt-cool with that. And it's simple, and it's encompassing, and it's non-judgmental, and that's what I have to say about that.
Okay. The only problem I would have with cool is that it's sort of I don't know, sort of that's the social context of that and a kind of exclusivity. So I don't know, but we'll hear what other listeners think. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Surfcraft says, I don't know why anyone would want to identify as queer. It has a pejorative connotation. Well, that was the whole idea, though, behind the sort of reappropriation or appropriation of the term, because literally queer means different, and so in gay men and lesbians appropriating or reappropriating that term, it sort of throws it back in the face of those that would make that a pejorative. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. If you are someone who is LGBTQ, what is the term that you use to identify your larger group identification, and how often do you use that versus a more specific identifier for yourself and your specific of sexuality or gender? 866-893-KPECC. Let me go back to Jonathan Rauch of The Atlantic. I have to admit what our caller said, Chris, about Q, the Star Trek thing. You know, that was the first thing that came to my mind with just the letter Q. Has anybody else brought that up to you?
No, people have brought up QAnon. Of course, I'm a Star Trek fan to the bone, so
that
having
might be
Star
part
Trek
of
in the picture, that is a feature, not a bug.
All right. 866-893-KPECC. I mean, what we're seeing here, and I guess in response to your piece in The Atlantic as well, is there is not an easy solution here. There's nothing just obviously people are identifying that they connect with.
Well, there's no easy solution if you're determined to find a technically accurate term for each and every group out there. And that's why I say, forget it, everybody. Just the letter. Doesn't even matter what the letter is. I said, I pick Q, you pick some other letter. But let's change the message from naming every group based on sexual or gender characteristics or positioning to just the thing we have in common, which is seeking equal rights and freedom for all Americans, regardless of sexual orientation or gender or anything else. That's all it's really about.
Andrew in Long Beach. Good to have you with us, Andrew. What do you propose?
Hi, I prefer the letter W for welcoming, because I think today we're looking at a movement towards somebody saying I'm sexually welcoming. And I have a lot of straight friends who identify as gay quite often, you know, as participating in gay pride events and otherwise, because they're sexually welcoming. So if it were up to me, I would just say I'm sexually welcoming.
And so the implication there isn't even necessary that it doesn't deal with necessarily one's identity or one's practices. It just has to do with their state of mind toward diverse sexuality and gender.
Do you want to label people in general? I don't want to be labeled as a gay person. I want to be labeled as a welcoming person.
All right, Andrew, appreciate it. Jonathan Rauch, what do you think?
Very interesting suggestion. And a line that got cut out of my article that I kind of wish it stayed in said that one advantage of Q is people who are cisgender heterosexuals could also consider themselves Q if they were welcoming, if they signed into this idea of equality for everyone. So I like the W idea.
All right. Tony in San Diego says, I have a problem using Q. It brings to mind queer, which I think has a negative connotation. Tony says, I prefer gay as an umbrella term. And, you know, Jonathan, can you speak to that point? Was it lesbians who first expressed concern about using gay as a generic term for gay men and lesbians?
I think so. Yeah. There was a sense that these communities have somewhat different needs, although they're politically united. And it just became necessary to have a way to distinguish. Homosexual doesn't do that. But, you know, you sometimes had to talk about them as separate groups. So you started saying lesbians, and then you started differentiating that from gay, and gay became gendered. But the idea of just using gay for everybody has a very deep pedigree. It goes way back to the origins of the movement. I just think it's too late for it now. It's not going to happen.
Cindy in Seal Beach, good to have you with us. Very short on time. Your suggestion.
Hi. Yeah, I'm bisexual, and I'm suggesting sexual identity minority. So SIM, S-I-M.
Sexual identity minority. SIM. Jonathan, quick thought on that.
I love all these suggestions. It's time to start thinking fresh, and I'm thrilled if that starts to happen.
We've had a couple suggestions on our AirTalk page to actually have a contest, get the whole country involved on this. Elise says,
I'm in.
Elise says, why not curved, as in anything that isn't straight?
This is great.
Curved. That's interesting. All right. Hey, Jonathan, this has been fun. Thank you so much for talking with us about your essay in The Atlantic. Contributing editor to The Atlantic, he's also with the Brookings Institution, Jonathan Rauch. As always, thanks for joining us on Air Talk. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Emily Blunt is Terry's guest, and I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk.